In July 2008, a 21-year-old man who'd arrived in Australia as a refugee from Somalia was sentenced to 6 years in prison for the rape of a woman as she lay unconscious in a Doncaster nightclub. Throughout the trial, Farah Jama maintained his innocence. But despite there being no witnesses, no security camera footage, no phone records, no car records, he was found guilty of rape solely on the basis of DNA evidence presented. That evidence was later revealed to be tainted, and after 8 months in prison, Farah Jama's conviction was quashed. Journalist and former lawyer Julie Sago has written a new book about this case. I spoke with her earlier.
Good to be with you, Fran.
Julie, the CSI effect, the so-called CSI effect, tell us about that and this story.
This story happened to a Somali teenager, Farah Jama. He was charged, put on trial and convicted of rape, of having raped a 48-year-old woman who was found unconscious in a nightclub. The only evidence that the police had against him was DNA. And at the time when the miscarriage of justice came to light, when it was revealed that the DNA sample had been contaminated, there were many lawyers who were saying that this is an example of the CSI effect, that jurors, for instance, have become so used to watching those kind of shows, the CSI franchise, and that they've become accustomed to the idea that a crime can just be solved with lightning speed within an hour, you know, almost always with forensic evidence, and that this kind of evidence is infallible. After the miscarriage of justice came to light, the Victorian government appointed a former Supreme Court judge, Frank Vincent, to inquire into the case. He found that the DNA evidence cast a kind of spell over the minds of the people involved in the case, made them see things that just weren't there, and put aside logic. In my book, I call it a kind of hypnotic suggestion that took over.
So that hypnotic suggestion, you talked about the jury and the CSI effect, but also the judge. From reading your book, the judge, Lacava, says the jury cannot have viewed the facts in any other way. But that's an interesting thing for a judge to say when the facts are only based around this DNA sample. As you say, no eyewitnesses, no security footage, nothing to place this young man at the scene of the crime.
I think that's right, what Judge Lacava said. The jury really couldn't have seen it any other way, because of the information that was presented to them. The prosecutor in this instance said to them, look, we have this evidence, and this evidence is rock solid. Those were his words. The defence was in the position of saying, look, either this rape didn't happen at all, or if it did happen, Farah Jama was not responsible. They probably made a tactical error in leading this alibi testimony from Farah Jama's members of his family and a friend. This alibi consisted of them saying that Jama was home, that the father was dying, and that they were all standing around reciting the Quran all night long.
Mm-hmm.
None of this came across particularly well to the jury. So I'm not surprised that the jury came to the decision that they came to, and they were a very inquiring jury. They asked a lot of questions. And in terms of Judge Lacava himself, look, it has to be said that early on in the proceedings, he actually asked the defence barrister, look, is this a case of contamination? And the defence barrister said no.
Well, that's the critical point, isn't it? Because, in fact, when it comes down to it, it was a case of contamination,
it was up
to the Crown prosecutor, to the Crown solicitor, to work that out. So it wasn't those meant to be representing this young man and Farah Jama and doing the best for him that found that out. It was those who were prosecuting who found it out. So tell us about this contamination.
Okay, look, I won't tell you exactly how it happened because that's a spoiler. And my book is written partly as a detective story.
True.
It's an extraordinary story. It is bizarre, to say the least.
Well, let me put it this way then, having read the book, it is an extraordinary story, but it's also, when you read it, a very commonplace story. And what it brings into the foreground is how easy it is for DNA evidence to be contaminated.
I don't see this really as a story about DNA. Because, yes, the DNA did operate as a kind of hypnotic suggestion on everybody who was involved in the case, it seems. But really, the deeper question in my mind is, why did this happen to this particular individual?
And as you say in the book, though, the DNA evidence you've told us today has cast a spell over otherwise critical minds.
Yes.
But that's not the only spell you think that is cast.
You say,
I came to the realisation this spell gained its potency from the nature of the accused, a black African, a Muslim, a young man who, to borrow a phrase from the prosecutor, was not like most of us. That's why logic gave way to hypnotic suggestion. So this was an issue of race.
Oh, look, race, religion. I mean, he, like you say, he's an outsider. And at various points, I think this really played a major role in what happened to him. There was sort of this elephant in the room and this kind of question that hung over the entire trial and even before it, which was, how did the police get hold of Jama's DNA in the first place? The jury asked the question, and it was called the inevitable question by the judge. And the judge told the jury, look, that's irrelevant and you are not to speculate on this matter. In fact, the police got his DNA because of an incident that happened with a young woman and Jama and two of his friends. They met in a pool hall one night and they got together and went off in a car and certain sexual acts happened. The woman brought an allegation of sexual assault. She later withdrew that allegation. It had no basis and the matter didn't go any further.
Yet the DNA was still on the police database.
I believe that he was reluctant to be entirely candid about this episode and why he came to the attention of the police in the first place. And I believe that had this matter been fully aired with Jama, his family, even his lawyer, that things might have turned out differently for him.
Julie Sago, thank you very much for joining us on Breakfast.
Thank you.
That's Julie Sago. She's a lawyer and journalist and author of the book The Tainted Trial of Farah Jama, which is published by Wild Dingo Press.